Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Apple is an innovation machine, and this week, with its customary flair, Apple announced its new iPhone 11. And if you're not one of those Apple acolytes who hang on CEO Tim Cook's every single word, the big hurrah for the iPhone 11 is a faster chip, a new camera, and, drumroll please, all-day battery life. Woohoo! Okay, so yes, I am a curmudgeon who longs for the days when my bar phone battery lasted an entire week on one charge, but let's just dare to ask for one moment, what is all the hype about? Where is the innovation here? Can Apple's iPhone 11 just be seen as another example of where we all are as a world now, a society that is so in love with innovation simply for the sake of it, that we're fetishizing innovation? Well, our guests today say it's time to remember something very key about how we live. That most of life, in business, in our infrastructure, it's not about making new things or even wild new things, but about taking care of things, about maintaining what we already have. They say it's time to champion the maintainers. So this hour On Point, rethinking the cult of innovation and celebrating the maintainers. And you can join us. I want to know if you're one of those folks who are going to run out and buy that new iPhone 11 simply because of its whiz-bang new battery life, or if you really just reject everything that I'm saying right now and believe that innovation is absolutely essential to everything that we do, how we think, how we learn, the businesses that we run. Or do you hear what our guests are about to say, that maybe we ought to rethink that cult of innovation? Well, Andrew Russell and Lee Vinsel are both historians of technology. And back in 2016, they wrote an essay in the journal Eon titled Hail the Maintainers. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. And Andrew Russell is a historian of technology and dean of arts and sciences at the State University of New York Polytechnic Institute. He joins us today from Syracuse, New York. Andrew Russell, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks, Meghna. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. And Lee Vinsel is a historian of technology, a professor of science and technology studies at Virginia Tech, and he's with us from Blacksburg, Virginia. Lee Vinsel, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks so much for having us.
Okay, it's great to have you both here, and I got my chance to beat up on Apple here a little bit.
can help you with that.
So help me. I mean, am I wrong to sort of poo-poo this new whiz-bang iPhone 11 and its all-day battery life?
No, I mean, I think you see this a lot with electronics and digital technology today where, you know, slightly new things get hailed as major transformations. And we can also think about, you know, how especially Apple's products, but many other people's products are created to be unmaintainable. So they're really based on keeping us constantly buying new things. The other thing to think about is just how kind of what we call innovation speak, the ideology and lingo that we've developed for thinking about technology leads us to neglect basic things like maintenance and repair and just keeping the world going.
So, Andrew Russell, tell us more about that. I mean, when we say that we've created this whole language around innovation speak, I mean, I'm hard-pressed to think of a sector or an industry that hasn't adopted that language.
It's true. It's everywhere. It's not only in digital technologies. You've said it's in education, which is a sector that Lee and I work in. It's in healthcare. You know, any sector that you can think of, it's there. But the fact is that our lived reality doesn't really reflect that we need those innovations. And I was just thinking about this on my drive in today in the studio that we're in now, where we're, you know, it went over transportation infrastructure, we're over radio infrastructure, and these are all old technologies. And I only got here, and we're only talking because there are people working really hard to make the old technologies work.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to leave Apple alone here for just another a minute because I just it's such a it's such an important example of both the upside and the downside of our focus on innovation here. So first of all, let me just play a little bit more from their announcement this week about the iPhone 11. This is Phil Schiller. He's Apple's Senior Vice President for Worldwide Marketing, and he was one of the folks at the Steve Jobs Theater in Cupertino, California, extolling... My producer has written this language, so I'm hanging it on your hat there, Steph. Extolling, quote, the awesomeness of the newest iPhone.
This is the most advanced and detailed iPhone we've made yet. It's made of a surgical-grade stainless steel. That back is a single piece of machine glass with an optical PVD coating. It has a beautiful new matte textured finish that looks great and feels awesome in your hand. iPhone 11 Pro comes in some gorgeous new finishes. This is an all-new midnight green.
Apple Senior Vice President of Worldwide Marketing Phil Schiller there, and I know some folks listening to that are probably actually drooling with desire. But let's go back to 2007 at the Macworld Conference when Steve Jobs unveiled the very first iPhone. Now here's what he said then.
An iPod. A phone. And an internet communicator. An iPod. A phone. Are you getting it? These are not three separate devices. This is one device. And we are calling it iPhone. Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
Steve Jobs in 2007. Now, Andrew and Lee, the reason why I wanted to play that is because I think it tells the story of how this language and focus on innovation has changed in this past decade, right? Because this latest iPhone 11, hurrah, it's got a midnight green color. But when the iPhone was first introduced in the, you know, in the sort of early-ish 2000s, 2007, It was an innovation that was transformative.
For sure.
So, yeah. So you're not saying like down with innovation, are you?
No. We're not anti innovation or anti technological change. I mean, you know, we're very happy to have antibiotics and air conditioning and so many things. But I think that you're pointing to the kind of superficiality of innovation speak that's developed in Silicon Valley and in tech worlds. I mean, who would deny that cell phones and digital technologies have been transformative, you know, to journalism, to politics, to so much else? But, you know, that new iPhone announcement sounded like a Saturday Night Live skit of like a spoof of change. So I think that, that's the critique here. Andy, what do you think?
I thought those announcements together sounded as much like a religious revival as they did anything talking seriously about technology.
Well, those Apple conferences tend to have a fervent feel about them, for sure.
They sure do. And, full credit to Steve Jobs and the team at Apple. That's their job. And they've done a tremendous job getting these things and, you know, selling them and improving people's lives to the extent that we can say they've improved people's lives. What they don't focus on is, as we discussed before, the hard work that it takes to keep those systems going. And that's just leaving aside the downsides of having these things in our hands, in our pockets, in our lives 24/7.
Yeah. So I want to talk with you about your idea of celebrating the maintainers. And we will get to that in depth in just a moment. But Andrew, since you said like that these Apple conferences tend to feel more like religious a tent revival meeting for tech, but it's not just there. Like, are you and Lee saying that this belief in innovation for the sake of innovation has become kind of a faith across the United States, across how we do business? That in and of itself is the end goal, is simply to innovate.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a confusion of means and ends. And so healthcare is a great example. where we all would agree that the ends are to improve people's lives, improve people's comfort, and you know, make life better for everyone. But is it always the case that innovation and new medicines and new treatments is the best way to do that? Or are there cases where maybe innovation or new treatments actually distract from the work that nurses do or that hospitals do in making people feel better? So that's just one example. Now, if you listen to the executives and the scientists in the medical space, they will be pushing innovation. And the people who raise funds for hospitals and for medical schools, they'll be pointing to the breakthrough treatments. But our point is to simply and you know, those are really important, to be sure. Our point is that the talk, the rhetoric, is out of balance. And we need to think about that balance and really think about the ends and not just be fixated on innovation as an end in itself, when it's really just a means to an end.
Okay, so Lee, I'm going to provide the devil's advocate pushback here, though. I mean, in the world that we live in now, I think people are right to follow that mantra of innovate or die. Like, it is the means by which progress happens, and that groups and individuals and businesses who don't actually see innovation as part of what they do to try and improve or make new things or better their business practices, they are going to be pushed by the wayside.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to think about how most innovation is actually incremental and boring and happens deep in the guts of industry. And industry's been doing that forever. You know, I mean, I think part of the point is that what we call innovation speak, using the word innovation, has only been developed in the last 30 or 40 years, but industry's been doing this since the Industrial Revolution starts in the, you know, the mid-19th century in America, for instance. So there's no problem there, but I think that, you know, the idea of disruption, for instance, mm-hmm. that we're all going to be disrupted by digital technology, or that, you know, I heard a guest on your last hour talking about automation and robots taking away jobs. There's just not evidence for these kinds of claims that we're seeing some kind of rapid shift.
Well, Lee Vinsel and Andrew Russell, hang on here for just a second because this is so fascinating. We just have to take a really quick break. And when we come back, we'll pick up with your idea of celebrating the maintainers over the innovators. Has the cult of innovation gone too far? We'll hear your answers when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Andrew Russell and Lee Vinsel. They are a pair of historians of technology from the State University of New York Polytechnic Institute. That's where Andrew is. And from Virginia Tech. That's where Lee Vinsel works. And they're writing about pushing back against the cult of innovation and instead celebrating what they call the maintainers. Now, this is something that maybe isn't necessarily new, as Lee and Andrew point out in their writings. Back in 2012, the vaunted Wall Street Journal got into the, quote, innovation bashing act, at one time counting that in just a one-month period in 2012, more than 250 books with innovation in the title were published and that the term had begun to lose meaning. So do you agree with that? Do you think we've taken the cult of innovation too far, or not far enough? And when Andrew and Lee say we should celebrate the maintainers, or the people who keep our world going as it is, What do you think about that? So Andrew and Lee, you know, I've said this phrase, the maintainers, a couple of times, and I think listeners should just have a chance to hear from you. Who are the maintainers? What do you mean? What do they do? And Lee, I'll let you take that first.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's different ways to define maintenance. We tended to define it pretty broadly to include, you know, mechanics, repair people who keep systems going, janitors and others who keep our buildings clean and, you know, put together, and all the way to things like teachers and nurses and people involved in caregiving. So, that, you know, for us, it's really about the kind of war with entropy. So the world's falling apart all the time. We know this. This is fundamental to our physics. And the maintainers are the people who, you know, fight entropy and try to keep our world in some state of order.
And Andrew, it seems like under that definition, the maintainers are everywhere.
Yeah, that's right. We're all maintainers and we're all maintained. So one of the interesting things to think about once you accept that premise is what aspects of your life are you a maintainer, and in what aspects of your life are you maintained, and who is maintaining you? Who or what is maintaining you? So absolutely, we're all maintainers, we're all maintained, but it's certainly true that in some people's work and whole classes of jobs in different industries, as Lee has said, the bulk of the maintenance work falls to certain kinds of people in certain occupations.
Mm. So then what do you think are some of the consequences of having a lot of public attention surrounding innovators versus maintainers? What are we missing when we're not talking about the work of maintainers?
I was just interviewing a tech worker the other day who works at a software company in the Midwest, and software is a well-known package used in academia, and the company is constantly focusing on introducing new features to the system. I mean, that's how they hype the change to sell the thing. Meanwhile, this guy was doing IT for the company, so running the infrastructure, including their sales and payment systems and all these kinds of things that make a run. And the system was, he said, held together with, you know, duct tape and, you know, wire, basically. He and his colleagues were, you know, buying spare parts off of eBay because their systems were so old and running Windows 95 and such. And so, you know, within organizations, and you see this in, you know, in universities, in government, there's a lot of hype put on the new things, you know, what we're going to do that's new. But meanwhile, they're often, you know, failing to take care of those systems and not giving resources to the necessary systems to keep things going. And those people who keep it up often don't receive recognition within the organization and often are, you know, don't receive compensation and other kind of benefits that, you know, the so-called innovators within the organization do.
Well, Andrew, I mean, as you and Lee have written, even within tech, the vast majority, according to your numbers, the vast majority of people who work in tech would essentially be maintainers under this rubric.
That's right. There's estimates going back as far as the 1970s and 1980s of what percent effort different organizations devote to maintenance versus design or introducing new technologies. And the numbers for maintenance fluctuate, and they're tough to nail down, but they're usually somewhere between 60 and 80%.
And just for like software.
For software, that's right. And so if Lee's right, if you talk to people who work in these worlds, especially in companies that are successful, companies like you know, Netflix or other streaming companies, they devote tremendous amounts of resources to keeping their uptime in the 99.99 percentile and that sort of thing. That's what customers want. But that's not really what's recognized in their PR, and that's not what people think about when they think about those companies and those services. They just want them to work. And if they don't work, then people will just go somewhere else.
Yeah.
So that's one of the issues of the disconnect, really, that you're talking about. People just don't understand it.
I mean, but would Netflix be as successful as it is if it put – and I'm obviously I am not diminishing the importance of the work of maintainers here, but from a business standpoint, would they be as successful if they said, you know, here are our armies of software engineers who keep your stream coming to you versus like, here's all the new ways we're going to get you the content that you want?
It's an interesting thought experiment.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Lee.
I think Netflix is an interesting example because it's like a truly disruptive firm, right? Like Blockbuster Video does not exist anymore.
Right.
And so they, you know, they're deeply innovative in that way, and they offer new services. But I think that, you know, it's a nice thought experiment precisely because one of the ways they competed is on uptime, right? Like high quality service. And what's made that high quality service a reality is that they have some of the best software and, you know, infrastructure maintenance teams in the planet. And so, you know, that's just kind of left out of the picture. And the same is true of Amazon. You know, Amazon is, its most profitable service is Amazon Web Services. It's cloud computing.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally, you know, maintenance work. Sure, there's an, you know, an important innovation in the thing itself, but it's just like people fail to realize how much effort is being put into creating that quality service.
Right. So these examples bring up two, I think, of the most compelling points that you make in the writing, Lee, that you and Andrew have done. And one of it is that with our sort of cultural focus on innovation, it has rendered invisible the amount of work, or in your language, the absolute centrality of the work that goes into simply keeping the world going as we know it. And I just, that stopped me in my tracks for a second, because I think, honestly, like, I don't give enough thought, any thought in the course of an average day to the millions of people who are working quietly to keep our world functioning. I mean, that it's quite a sobering thought.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting is that when we've been talking to, you know, hundreds of these people over the last couple of years as we've been researching and organizing around this, and there's a split. On the one hand, I think it would be good if there were more recognition and more status and certainly more compensation devoted to these people. But on the other hand, a lot of them don't want to be heroes, even though we would consider them heroes, whether it's nurses or repairmen or plumbers in the case of something that happened in my house. They don't want to be called out as heroes. They just like to keep their heads down and do the work. And a job well done is satisfaction for them. So it's an interesting little paradox here when we talk about the public perceptions of the work that they do, because they're not necessarily chomping at the bit to jump into the headlines.
Mm. Well, Lee and Andrew, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us, so I want to get some of their voices in here. We are talking with Andrew Russell and Lee Vinsel. They're a pair of historians of technology who've been writing for quite some time, pushing back against basically the cult of innovation and saying that instead we ought to be celebrating the maintainers. Let's go to Frank, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Go ahead, Frank.
Oh, so I guess my point would be going back to the original example of the iPhone. I think it's great that, you know, they're coming out with new products and things like that, but having 1100 or however much it costs new iPhone 11, I think more thought should be looked into how can we make things cheaper and more efficient for people, like being of the millennial generation, that I can't necessarily afford an iPhone 11. How can we help with improving upon efficiency and bringing the cost down of some of these products that are sort of lorded at, you know, the hailing of efficiency or, innovation.
Mm-hmm. Well, Frank, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Brenda, who's calling from Ellicott City, Maryland. Brenda, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I agree with you that it's like a cult of let's all get something new and let's throw everything away. And also, I resent that everybody acts like, just because I have a phone with a QWERTY keyboard, I'm too stupid to understand a new phone. I don't want a new phone. When I drop my phone off a ladder, I can go pick it up, and it works. And it's just terrible that I have to fill up the ice cube tray. It's no big deal. My refrigerator's 20 years old. It's not in the landfill, you know? I mean, why don't we just keep what we have if it works and quit throwing things away? You know, that would be a significant way to help save the planet.
Yeah, well, Brenda, thank you so much for your call. So Lee and Andrew, a couple of interesting calls there. Let's just pick up with Brenda's thought that if we don't focus on maintainers or maintaining what we already have, that there are obviously some major you know, environmental implications. Is that part of what you're thinking about why we need to you're suggesting we shift our focus away from innovation? And Andrew, I'll start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. There's pretty good documentation about the escalating environmental costs of the whole supply chain of building all this new stuff, from the mining of rare earth minerals to the mountains of plastic in the ocean. And I definitely think it's true that there's a connection there, that there's not only corporations who want to keep producing new things to support their own bottom lines and producing things that are not easy to repair, but also consumers are demanding those things. And so to the extent that that's a problem, and we think it's a huge problem, then there's a lot that can be done both on the supply and on the demand side.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I mean, just to connect it to Apple for a second. So, you know, if Apple wants to just sell luxury items, basically, to, you know, a certain class of people, that's fine. But I think the argument is that we should be able to maintain and repair those things for a long time. And I would encourage listeners to check out the website iFixit. The folks there do teardowns of phones and digital gadgets, and they show over and over again that Apple's especially bad when it comes to maintenance and repair. And there's lots of toxic things that are, you know, instead of keeping these phones around for longer and making them maintainable, they basically are things that have to be disposed of. So there's a lot that corporations could change to make things, you know, more maintainable and, you know, have the environmental benefits that go along with that.
Mm. Now, Andrew and Lee, let me ask you, really, one of the things that you get to in your thinking and writing about the maintainers actually has to do with the moral implications of the invisibility of a lot of this work, right? I mean, especially around issues of infrastructure, whether it be digital, physical infrastructure. I mean, Andrew, can you talk about that?
Certainly. Yeah, it's absolutely right. And we try not to use the word invisible because we like to emphasize that people are making the choice to neglect maintainers. They're here. They're among us. We can see them. They're rendered invisible or rendered silent because of choices that we make. So that's absolutely a moral issue. And there are things that we can – very simple things we can do about it, including recognizing the people who do that kind of work and thanking them. Very simple things. But it also rolls up into having some pretty significant economic consequences. So the people who are doing maintenance work throughout society generally aren't paid too well. And they have families. They're generally the working poor. And there's a lot of work done on this subject by a research group in the United Way called ALICE. ALICE stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained but Employed. So basically the working poor. And they've got a ton of data on how these how ALICE families are represented all over the country, state by state, county by county. And the fact is that if they were compensated better, and making whether it's a living wage, you know, there's a lot of discussion that could go into that. But if we compensated the maintainers better, there would be net benefits to the entire society. Hmm. So the moral and the economic are really closely related.
Interesting. Now, Lee, let me ask you if. Regarding, say, just our physical infrastructure, I mean, we were talking about transportation infrastructure near the beginning of the show, most of it, which is really old in the United States. Do you draw a line between – I mean, this is such a simplistic question, and I'm almost hesitant to ask it, but I'll do it anyway. Do you draw a line between, you know, our sort of fetishizing of innovation and our sort of collective ignoring of crumbling infrastructure?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, that's part of our argument. And, you know, we draw on a lot of people to make our arguments. One person we draw on around this is Chuck Marone and the group over at Strong Towns, which is a group that tries to help localities be sustainable, financially sustainable. And his point is that, you know, we often use federal money to build new infrastructure in towns, but then the towns are... you know, basically signing up to maintain and repair these infrastructures for the rest of time until we get rid of the infrastructure. And his point is that it's just totally an unsustainable system. There's lots of impetus for politicians to kind of do ribbon cuttings and stand in front of new, you know, bring in money and do new things. But what it's doing is burdening us with, you know, incredible infrastructural debt And, you know, you look at things like the American Society of Civil Engineers Infrastructure Report Card, where, you know, the U.S. gets like a D plus or whatever when it comes to infrastructure. And, you know, this is, it comes in part from an obsession with growing and building new things and not really thinking about the long haul and how we're going to be able to take care of these things over time.
Well, as you and Andrew have written in the New York Times, for example, you say that political inaction around allocating resources necessary for preventative maintenance in transportation is, quote, inaction that is a symptom of a deeper problem. One that is too seldom discussed. Americans have an impoverished and immature conception of technology, one that fetishizes innovation as a kind of art and demeans upkeep as mere drudgery. I mean, is that what you think?
Yeah, it is. I think, you know, we learned from Chuck Marone at Strongtowns about infrastructure, and then, you know, the more we've been working on our book and doing research for our group, The Maintainers, we just see this everywhere. We see it in universities where there's a lot of fetishization of, innovation, but not taking care of the infrastructure. You see it in corporations, like I said, that software company. I think this is very widespread.
Well, Lee Vinsel and Andrew Russell, stand by. We are talking about Andrew and Lee's thinking around what they call the maintainers and pushing back against the cult of innovation. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Andrew Russell. He's a historian of technology and dean of arts and sciences at the State University of New York Polytechnic Institute. And his collaborator, Lee Vinsel, who's a historian of technology as well and a professor of science and technology studies at Virginia Tech. And together they've been writing for several years about what they call the maintainers and pushing back against the cult of innovation in America. For example, they've recently written this, that, quote, "While innovation, the social process of introducing new things, is important, most technologies around us are old, and for the smooth functioning of daily life, maintenance is more important." And Andrew and Lee argue that we are not paying enough attention to the people who are doing that maintenance. Let's go to Fred, who's calling from Duxbury, Vermont. Fred, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, folks. I have a couple of things. I've been a maintainer. I've been a blue-collar worker, a mechanic, all my life, truck driver, et cetera. And I've noticed a discrepancy or that I don't want to call it racism, but, you know, I have dirty hands. You know, my hands show that I work hard. And my pants and my boots show I work hard. I'm not a tech person. My brother, on the other hand, is older. He went to college. He is a tech person. And so you're always going to be a worker bee all your life, he says. But he can't change his own spark plugs on his car. I just noticed that throughout my life, that if you're not on the cutting edge, if you didn't go to college, if you're not an innovator, so to say, and I noticed that a lot with my own children. I have two boys. They're of the hipster age, and a lot of their friends are techies that are, you know, all their work is done on a laptop and a computer on their home somewhere. Both of my boys are hands-on workers, and I even notice it that it's generational.
Yeah,
from me in the 70s to my kids in the teens.
Fred, I'm going to take it back from you there. Thank you so much for your call. I think I hear your line kind of getting a little rough on us. I mean, speaking of maintenance, we need maintenance on our phone lines. But Fred, thanks so much. And Lee, I mean, reflect on what Fred was saying, especially he was seeing sort of a that even with in his kids' generation, or I perhaps might say even more with his kids' generation, there's this lack of respect, as he said, for doing some of this work.
Yeah, I heard him say a couple really fascinating things. The first was that, you know, we often kind of mark out maintainers. They're visible to us. You know, they often wear uniforms that kind of set them aside as a certain kind of caste. So it's true that we can literally see maintainers in lots of different areas. But the other thing I heard is, you know, something we hear often, which is about the loss of skills in keeping the world going. So here in Blacksburg, for instance, it's very hard to find tradespeople to work on your house. You know, I heard there was an HVAC guy who is quitting at the end of the year just because he's working constantly, and the money is just not worth it for him anymore. And you hear this a lot with the trades where there's just not enough kind of people entering. Those are two big things.
Well, so Andrew, I want to. Fred made me think about circling back to something that you and Lee were saying earlier, because a lot of this quote unquote maintenance work is work that has historically been done, for example, as you're saying, healthcare, work at home, et cetera, by women. And now more so people of color as well, so that when we're not paying attention to this particular kind of work of the maintenance work of our society, we are not paying attention to broad swaths of people as well.
I'm glad you brought that up. I was reflecting on your question about the moral implications during the break of this distinction between the innovators who are praised and the maintainers who are ignored. And I think it's no coincidence that the two voices we heard at the top of the hour were the two white guys in Silicon Valley praising, you know, this really expensive new device that's going to change everything. But really, the people who are doing the work are disproportionately people of color, women, and that's been true, and it continues to be true. And it's just, you know, it's really unfortunate, and it's a cultural problem that I think we've begun to recognize, and that critics of quote unquote Silicon Valley have begun to recognize. I think firms are trying to do something about it, but it's such a deeply entrenched problem throughout the educational system, as you've said, that children are being driven to think they need to be innovators and inventors when the opposite is true. And we need to structure conversations and structure compensation in different ways.
Well, Lee, just for 1 second, because we have an example of it's something that you and Andrew have written about, which is exactly the point that Andrew's making about how even around education, young people are getting a lot of this innovation messaging and getting it intensely. So here's one of the examples that you provided in one of your papers. It's about the University Innovation Fellows Program. And the idea behind this program is to get students to teach themselves and their universities to become, quote, change agents. Now, here's Humira Fasihuddin, who is a co-director of the University Innovation Fellows Program, talking about one of their projects in India.
India is on the brink of an innovation revolution. Universities and colleges in India need to prepare for that innovation revolution. Students need to understand how to solve and tackle real-world problems and develop innovative solutions that benefit society.
So, not to pick on Humir, but I will, she said the word innovation 3 times in that little clip, and I'm not exactly sure what this program does, Lee. So this is one of your examples.
Yeah, well, who knows what it does? I mean, I think they hold events and talk about innovation. I mean, I think, I want to kind of go back to your point about race and gender. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about development and aid to poor countries, how much, you know, the successful programs focus on helping women who are often doing maintenance and care work in their homes. And, you know, so Andy and I, our work draws on lots of things, but a lot of it's on feminist literature that points out so much of the kind of daily upkeep work that women do, you know, and how that goes unrecognized. And, you know, it's literally not counted in GDP, for instance, housework isn't. And, you know, if we thought about poor countries, you know, a lot of what they need, or poor places in the States, frankly, like, you know, places in Alabama and stuff, what those places need is basic infrastructure and help on those levels. They don't need, you know, a new gadget or design thinking or whatever is supposed to produce innovation necessarily.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to the phones and let's go to David, who's calling from Sarasota, Florida. David, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So on the subject of maintaining existing infrastructure and its, you know, its an impact to the environment and specifically building operations, building infrastructure. I've been in that industry since the 80s as an operating engineer. So, and I've seen it in many cities. I've been in Manhattan, and now I'm here in a beautiful Sarasota. And what happens in our industry is that we, you know, we emphasize the innovation and changing the equipment to a more efficient type and style when in fact, some of the equipment and most of the equipment we worked on, once maintained and operating the way it's intended or to its design, it does a fine job. So it's important to realize that when we introduce this recycled equipment back into the environment, it's a tremendous impact when if we were to maintain and make innovative changes to this equipment, quite frankly, you're doing a tremendous service by not impacting the environment. And we see it in many, many different ways and many, many different facets of building operations.
Well, David, thank you for that observation and for your call as well. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, this is a fantastic topic, and I'm definitely going to pick up this book also because this is right in my wheelhouse. For the last 15 years, this is all I do, is that, you know, I make engine swap kits to put Ford engines into VW vans to keep them on the road and maintain them. And I wanted to make two points. One was that I one of your earlier callers kind of touched upon it, which was this whole maintainer versus innovation thing is very kind of similar to the way young and elderly are viewed in our society. It's kind of, you know, you kind of relegate, you know, you keep them out of the main focus. It's not cool. It's not fashionable. But then the second thing I wanted to say, too, is it's not always mutually exclusive.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot of innovation that can go into the maintaining part as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do that every day. So,
Jim,
yeah,
say,
I think it's
go ahead, Lee.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is important. We try to make a distinction between actual innovation, like technological change, and what we call innovation speak, which is the way we've come to talk and think about these issues. Because when you get down into it, like, as social processes are not necessarily, you know, at ends with each other. We can talk about new things like iPhones and how they're not maintainable. But when you think about maintenance, how we do maintenance, maintenance has changed hugely over, you know, the last 100 years. So, you know, a lot of times it involves digital technologies and stuff. So it's important to emphasize that it's not like technological change and maintenance are necessarily at odds with each other. That's not our point.
Exactly. But one of the points that you're making, and I want to spend the last couple of minutes of the program on this, is what does focusing on maintenance or shifting our focus allow us to do? Now, this is from some of your writing, Andrew and Lee, and you say, quote, in formal economic terms, innovation involves the diffusion of new things and practices. The term is completely agnostic about whether these things and practices are good. And then you go on and you say, what if we focus on maintenance? Well, that provides opportunities to ask questions about what we really want out of those technologies versus just the innovation itself. I mean, you're making an ethical argument here, Andrew. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, well, it's certainly the case that not everything should be maintained. So, you know, just like not all innovations should be celebrated, not everything should be maintained. And we can think of a number of systems that should not be maintained and are best cast aside, whether it's systems of political oppression or wasteful technological systems, inefficient technological systems, as we've been discussing. So that's one really important piece of our argument that, you know, just like we're not anti-innovation, we're also not reactionaries. And I think this most recent discussion about there being room for and the need for ingenuity and creativity in maintenance, that's a really important subtle point.
But I want to dig into this a little bit more, Andrew and Lee, because as we said a couple of times this hour, the talk around innovation has reached such a froth that there's confusion between innovation as a process versus an end, right? The means to the means versus the ends debate here.
Yeah.
And I'm just really interested about this idea that if we focus on maintenance more, as you ask, that allows us to ask questions about what do we want out of these technologies? What purposes are they actually trying to serve? What do we really care about? What kind of society do we want to live in? I mean, Lee, make the argument to me that bringing maintenance in or focusing on maintenance is the way to ask those questions.
I mean, I think it goes back to your earlier point about innovation being a kind of religion. You know, I think we've come to see technological change as the thing that's going to get us to the promised land, and it pretty clearly isn't. There's so many problems that have come with, you know, Silicon Valley and digital technology and stuff. It's not that. And I think when we move technology out of being the end in itself, and we start talking to each other about what kind of society do we want to live in, right? How do we want to live together? And realizing that no matter what kind of technology we introduce into the world, most of the work afterwards is going to be in keeping it going in just daily life. It opens up a new kind of conversation about what things we actually need, how we can plan for the long durée, and, you know, about how we can properly compensate and take care of each other.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Michael, who's calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I thought that you were making a very interesting point about, you know, how we decide together as a society to live together. And I think that is being hampered if we are not looking at the underlying motivation for this cult of innovation, right, which I think is the economic models, the way that we think about money and business mm-hmm. and how things work in our society, I think is a very important factor in how that works. You know, if a national economy or a business does not grow as much this year mm-hmm. than last year, then there must be something wrong. And then there's this panic in the market like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? It's like, well, nothing that humanity has ever created is meant to be permanent. Everything in nature goes through ebbs and flows, ups and downs. Why would we think that anything that we create would be any different mm-hmm. and not just the actual physical items, but any of the systems that we create,
yeah.
right?
Yeah,
and so we
totally.
Do have to decide together how we do that, but we first have to address the money issue.
Yeah.
If money becomes the most important deciding factor in your life over everything, then we cannot have a discussion, a meaningful discussion about how we live our lives together because we're too busy competing for money.
Yeah. And Michael, I'm going to take it back from you because we've just got a minute and a half left, and you've left us with a really interesting thought here. So thank you for your call. I mean, Andrew, do you want to just first respond to Michael saying that, like, really, his view at the very foundation of this issue is capitalism, really, and money?
He's right. When it comes down to it, someone has to pay. And systematically, societies have underestimated and underfunded how much we've had to pay for maintenance. So that's perfectly clear. But the point he's also making about having a conversation is equally important. And that's something that Lee and I have had a lot of fun doing, why hearing from these callers with these amazing questions is so much fun. We write, but we also hold conferences. So I want to plug our next conference in Washington next month. It's called Maintainers 3. And I bring it up because I think the best way to really get through these questions is through conversation.
So we've got about 30 seconds here. In your past maintainers conferences, what have people wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of these things just like these calls where people just come out of the woodwork with so many fascinating stories. So that's what we love the most is, you know, there's artists and professors and engineers and librarians and open source software people. And that's really, you know, what we'll see at the next conference. But what we love the most is people come out with their personal stories to tell about their stories about their lives as maintainers.
Yeah. Well, I have to say thank you to both of you because this has been completely fascinating. I mean, change is a fact of life. As you said, innovation has been with us for centuries. But maybe we ought to all do ourselves and our culture, our nation better by focusing on those folks who keep things going. So Andrew Russell and Lee Vinsel, thank you both so very much. I should let folks know they have a book about this coming out next year, so keep your eye out for that. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.